Welcome back to the program. Like the story of the blind man and the elephant, where each part you touch gives you a different picture of the whole. So too with China. Its mammoth scale makes it hard to see the whole picture. The China we mostly see and talk about is the urban China, Beijing, Shanghai, and dozens of other cities where 5 or 6 million people make them small, almost innocuous cities. But still there is rural China, a place in many ways untouched by China's progress, almost a country unto itself. That's what we're going to talk about today with my guest Michael Levy. He's an educator, writer, and traveler. He currently teaches in Brooklyn, New York, and he's written a book about his experiences in China entitled Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion. Michael Levy, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. What was it that sent you over to China for an extended period to begin with?
Boy, well, the story really begins with a pretty down time. I was living in New York City on September 11th, and like a lot of New Yorkers, like a lot of Americans, I was scared, I was uncertain, I was angry, and I wanted to do something about it, and what I decided to do was join the Peace Corps, which was an organization I had heard about. I knew JFK, I knew the 60s, the hippies, but when I started looking into it, I learned that over 200,000 Americans have served as Peace Corps volunteers, and I threw my name into the hat, and the good folks down in Washington, D.C. matched my skills with the needs in rural China and sent me to teach for about 2.5 years.
Talk a little bit about where that match came from. What were the skills you brought to bear, and why did somebody think rural China would be the place to be for you?
Well, I should say this. I really love the Peace Corps, but the application process is Byzantine, to say the least. It took more than a year from the beginning of the process until I was finally on the ground. But what ended up, I guess, making me a good candidate for the China program was my teaching experience. Every single student in China, from kindergarten through college, must take English. So they really are seeking a complete bilingual culture. But since this is a new 10-year-old process, they really lack the English teachers. So you go out into the villages in rural China, and the people who are teaching, say, sixth-grade English have a first-grade English level of speaking and listening and understanding. So they are pulling in teachers by the dozens, and Peace Corps is one of the major resources for rural Chinese kids who are trying to compete with their peers in Beijing and Shanghai, who have all of the resources at their disposal. And, you know, the kids in rural China, it's a pretty uphill battle for them.
Mm-hmm. This idea of a bilingual culture was certainly different than profoundly different from the experience you had seen here in the States, where we have a pretty monolingual culture.
Yeah. I think that, you know, Chinese language is becoming more and more available to kids here in the U.S., but, I remember growing up, I took Latin for a few years, and I don't remember any of it. I took Spanish for a few years, don't really remember any of it. It's a pretty shocking thing in the globalized world we live in to have so few people who are conversant in a foreign language, and I worry about that because, right now, English can get you around the world, but for kids who want to be involved in business or who just want to be travelers, learning that second language can really make a huge difference.
When you arrived in rural China, you brought with you your own preconceptions of China, your own idea of what you thought China would be like. Talk a little about that.
Oh, boy. Well, when I landed in China, I didn't speak a word of Chinese, and my understanding of China came through the American media, the New York Times, CNN, and I'm a news junkie, so I knew the Thomas Friedman story of China, which is of a booming China, and that's a real story. That's a really important story. There are 300 million Chinese living along the coast who are suddenly living more or less like Americans. They're eating McDonald's. Transformers was the biggest movie of the summer. And that's a really important story. However, that leaves a billion people out of the story. And so when I arrived in Guizhou province, which if you drop your finger on the middle of a map of China, you'll likely hit Guizhou. When I arrived, it was a completely different world. And I was blogging, and my friends and family back home, they were emailing me and saying, where the heck are you? Because they were reading the New York Times and then reading my blogs, and it really is a world apart.
Right. I mean, it really is almost a different country that you are in.
Yeah, when I describe China to my students here at the high school I teach at in Brooklyn, I give them this image, and I think it's helpful. Imagine the United States exactly as it is today, the same size, the same number of rich people, the same number of poor people, everything is exactly the same. But now drop a billion peasants in the middle of the country who are surviving on $3 a day. That's China. I mean, they do have rich people. Shanghai has the same income level as America. But combined with the 300 million is this huge group of people who live traditionally, who have this strange connection to Chairman Mao and communism, who don't really understand the city life, let alone American life. And that is the group of people that the Chinese government right now is really, really worried about, because there's a bit of unrest there, and unless those people feel that their lives are improving, China's in trouble.
And, of course, those people don't have access quite yet to the same level of communication and information, so it's still going to take a while before that rising expectation hits them completely.
Yeah, well, one of the most interesting things about teaching in that part of China was, as I got to know my students, as they started to trust me, we were able to start talking about access to information, politics, religion came up quite a bit because they had never met a Jewish guy before. And I was surprised at how unobtrusive the government is. It's not like Big Brother leaning over your shoulder, but at the same time, I was equally surprised by how little my friends and colleagues knew. They Google something and it's completely censored. And most of them didn't know about that and didn't really care. I mean, the biggest concern is getting a good job, having a brighter future for their kids. And that, I mean, I guess that's kind of a human concern. And I saw it really strongly in my friends and colleagues in Guizhou province.
And, of course, we have great misconceptions, even in the cities, great misconceptions about the government of China. We tend to think of it as this absolute Big Brother monolith, when, in fact, it is far more provincial and far more bifurcated than people expect.
Oh, totally. I mean, the idea that there's just this one dude sitting in Beijing pulling all the levers like the Great Oz, that's completely wrong. Now, the Communist Party is the one party in China by constitutional law. You cannot have another party in control. That's just the way it is. But within the party, there are huge battles. So we in the States, you know, we've got Democrats and Republicans, and they battle it out. In China, they have something similar. They have liberals in the Communist Party who want the party to have this free market and, like, this booming economy. And then there are, in their terms, conservatives who want to go right back to Chairman Mao and make everybody equal. So the fighting within the Communist Party is really, we would find it similar to our own political system.
Right. Talk a little bit about the desire on the part of the peasants of rural China, and how many of them really have the aspiration to move out of rural China and move to the coast, move to the cities.
Well, I guess the first thing to say that surprised me and is surprising to most Americans is that you cannot legally migrate within China as a Chinese citizen. So if you're from Guizhou province, you have to apply to be allowed to move to Beijing. And the applications are usually denied. The reason is that the Chinese government wants to control the migration to the cities. China's already had the biggest peaceful migration in human history. You know, tens of millions of people are moving to the cities. They don't want it to get out of control. So they say to Guizhou province, you can't come here unless you already have a job. And, of course, the jobs are hard to find. What that means is that my students would end up in what is the equivalent of an undocumented worker situation, similar to maybe someone from Mexico going up to Texas and doing the labor that isn't done for, you know, the minimum wages. And boy, does this create stress, it creates resentment, but for my students, they all wanted to get to the big cities, and some of them were willing to take this huge risk. But when I went back last summer, I found that most of the students hadn't, in the end, been willing to jump into this sort of undocumented labor pool, and they were actually teaching in tiny little middle schools and primary schools in the middle of nowhere, these very mountainous rural Chinese villages.
You talk about the emergence, the beginning of unrest in some of these parts. What is that about?
You know, I was actually really surprised that a couple weeks ago this didn't make bigger news. There was a migrant laborer who was beaten to death by the local police because he was protesting, you know, a ticket he was given or something like that. And it really reminded me of the beginning of the revolutions that have swept across the Arab world. Now, China seems to be controlling it much more carefully, but there's a lot of uncertainty in rural China. While at the same time, if you look at polls, the Chinese government really is one of the most popular governments in the world. And the reason is pretty simple. The average Chinese person's income has multiplied by 30 in the last 30 years. So people's lives are getting better, but if that pauses, even for a few years, the whole world could sort of start rumbling.
Is the life of the lives of people in rural China getting better? Is there trickle down? Are they feeling the progress?
Well, if you and I hopped on a plane and we flew over to Beijing and then took another little plane into rural China, I can guarantee you the first thing that you and I would say to each other when we land, and it's, holy cow, this place is polluted. It just punches you in the gut when you step off a plane. The air is poisoned. The water is poisoned. It's the consequence of this massive, unregulated boom. So income is absolutely better, and the kids today in China have much more access to the world, a world of products. But the consequence, and it's a consequence that every Chinese citizen knows about, is a really devastated environment. I can't stress enough how chilling it is to be over there and be breathing in the... Actually, I'll tell you a little story. The Peace Corps nurse, when I first arrived in China, she advised me to stop exercising because if I went jogging in Chengdu, the city we were in, I would breathe this poisonous matter more deeply into my lungs. So she said, just, you know, relax, and when you get back to America, you can go back to jogging.
One of the things you write a great deal about in your book is the food, and the idea that the food really was symbolic as well as plentiful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that one of the main themes in the book is this confusion I had over when to completely immerse myself and be a good guest, which to me means, you know, accepting what's served to you and you know, being very polite, and when to sort of defend the parts of my identity that weren't welcome in China. When should I eat pork, even though before I left I kept kosher? When should I talk about democracy, even though in China, hey, you're maybe not supposed to do that so much? And I really struggled to figure out how to balance these two things. Now, in the end, I really tried to be as immersed as possible in the culture, and that meant I ate everything that was served to me, and I ate more pork in 2 years than than the rest of my life combined. But you know what? I think it was a good decision, because eating food, sitting down to a meal, breaking bread, I mean, this is the beginning of relationships, the beginning of friendship. And I learned, first of all, how delicious the food is, and second of all, that that on issues like that, I can be flexible and still feel true to myself.
It's important to explain to our listeners that the food that you're talking about bears no relationship, maybe coincidental at best, to what we would consider Chinese food
here
in the U.S.
That is a very good point. Yeah, actually, I didn't know. I was like, why is this food so different from what I get, you know, in Chinatown or New York? And I did a little bit of research, and the reason is that our Chinese food in America was first cooked by the men who had come over to build the railroad. So they were sort of thinking, what was that dish that grandma once cooked? And they had never cooked before. These were young men. And they tried to put it together. That was the origin of American Chinese food. So that, it's just sort of this pale shadow of the real thing. And the real thing, Chinese food is very diverse. in the north they ate noodles, in the south they ate rice. Out west where I was, the food was wicked spicy. And I mean, from top to bottom, it's fresh, it's healthy, and so I miss it every day.
Mm-hmm. But it took you a little bit, a little while to acclimate to it.
Oh, it took a while, both mentally and physically. The spice really knocked me out for a few months, even though I do like spicy food. But even more than that, even more than just sort of making sure my stomach could handle it, it was wrapping my mind around, first of all, the animals that we were eating, from millipedes to dogs, but also wrapping my mind around the parts of the animals that we were eating. And in the end, what my Chinese friends explained to me, as you know, as we ate chicken talon or, you know, whatever it was, they said, listen, you know, we're not as rich as you Americans. We eat every part of the animal. This is just the way that we do it. And I really respect that. I mean, I try to be sort of an environmental ecological guy here in America. Throwing away parts of the animal that you can eat, it's not the best thing to do. So I don't know if I ever completely got comfortable with insects, but they are edible. And, you know, hey, protein is protein.
Going back to the reason you went over there, because you wanted to make a difference, you wanted to do something after 9/11, what do you think you accomplished in terms of that side of the equation?
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for asking that, because I really, you know, one of the best things about being able to go around and talk about this book is being able to talk about Peace Corps. It's a rough world out there, and a lot of foreigners have some pretty ugly misconceptions about Americans. But the Peace Corps is the one organization that we have that only goes where it's invited, requires its members to learn the host language, and really trains people to listen before speaking. I mean, it's a very gentle organization, and I think it does a fantastic job. How much peace does the Peace Corps bring? Well, I didn't go in thinking I was going to change the world. I went in knowing I would learn about a foreign culture, I'd make some friends, and hopefully, you know, plant a few seeds. And going back to China these last couple of summers and seeing the way that my students are now teaching little tiny Chinese kids, seeing the respect, when they speak of America, they speak of it with respect. I mean, I think that these little tiny things can make a difference. And I encourage people young and old, we had 21-year-olds, we had 75-year-olds, to, if they're thinking of doing service, if they really want to make a commitment to serving their country, really, Peace Corps is a good way to do it.
In addition to bringing over English language, you were bringing over American culture. Talk about the appetite for that.
Yeah, well, I was sometimes surprised by what my students expected of me. At times, it was pretty laid back. We would sing Backstreet Boys songs, or, I mean, for some reason they loved Celine Dion. We did a lot of karaoke together. And that, you know, obviously that's just fun and mild. But at times, some of the topics that my students in rural China really yearned for were things that they couldn't talk to their parents. They couldn't talk to their teachers. Things like religion, God, spirituality. Chairman Mao tore that stuff out of China, violently suppressing Buddhism along with the other traditional religions. So young people today, who are now again allowed to at least think about these things, they don't know where to turn. And of course, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not a priest, I'm just a regular guy. But they wanted to talk about it. What is this God that Westerners believe in? And then, you know, okay, so that's pretty heavy. The more enjoyable thing than that, even, they love talking about romance. And again, this is a part of Maoism. You weren't supposed to fall in love with another person. You were only supposed to love the chairman. So my students, they were pretty confused about love, and they, you know, the Western love story was something they all enjoyed, Romeo and Juliet or Jack and Rose from Titanic. And so they would come to me for romantic advice.
Going back to religion a moment, you talk about that they were really afraid to even talk about it.
Yeah, the rules in China are unclear to everyone. So my students would have to whisper about certain things. They wouldn't really know if they were allowed to ask certain questions. And I didn't really know if I was allowed to give certain answers. So a lot of this discussion would take place in my office hours when it was just me and a couple of students who I knew and trusted sitting around. And again, I should emphasize, it's not like the secret police were listening on the other side of the door, but you know, there were stories out there, stories of people sort of getting harassed or losing a job. And so my students were very, very careful. And the other piece that has to be thrown in is that the only other foreigners who had ever really been to Guizhou province, other than Peace Corps volunteers, were American missionaries. So there was a Mormon couple, there was a Seventh-day Adventist couple. So the perception of Americans in the minds of a lot of my friends was that we are all evangelical Christians. And that was an important myth to dispel.
And how did you begin to dispel that?
It started on the first day when my hosts, you know, they served millipede, and I wasn't prepared for it. I freaked out, and in my desperation, just total freaking out, I said, "Oh, I can't eat this because I'm Jewish, and you know, millipedes aren't kosher." And there was a pause. Everyone sitting around the table, kind of looking at each other, and then they basically gave me a round of applause, and they said, "You're Jewish, just like Karl Marx." And that was, I nodded. I said, "Yes, just like Karl Marx." And that, you know, that was the beginning of my comfort telling people in China I was Jewish. I didn't know how they were going to react, but almost across the board, they would say, just like, you know, Comrade Marx, that great Jewish communist.
Were you surprised at the level of relative sophistication and education on the part of so many of the younger people in rural China?
I had heard the typical story that the Chinese students that I would meet would be sort of robotic, would be very, very dedicated, very respectful, be able to memorize everything, but, you know, like a robotic creature, have no creativity. And what I saw as I you know, dove deeper into the school system was that that's not who these young people are. That's just who they're told to be. So in my classroom, when we would, you know, put on a play, or when I would ask them to do something creative, they just exploded with ideas and smiles and fun. But the consequence of a high stakes, you know, testing only school system is that it kind of deadens the educational process. And school is a miserable place in China. And one of the things that my university asked me to do was just let the kids have a good time. It's not something they're used to.
What do you think is the biggest mistake that we make, or the potential consequences of the mistake of seeing China only in terms of urban cosmopolitan China?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of issues there. One of the big ones is this. If we want to understand why China does what it does, why Beijing makes the decisions that it makes, we have to understand that the Communist Party isn't looking at us. It doesn't care about the United States. It doesn't care about Barack Obama. What the Communist Party really cares about is the billion people living in the Chinese interior who control China's future. If those billion people are satisfied, everything's going to be fine. If those billion people feel like the gap between the rich and the poor is too big, or that the pollution just becomes too intense, that's where we are going to make mistakes in our assumptions about what China's going to do. The other thing that I hope that we can remember, and that I hope my Chinese friends remember as well, is there's always a difference between a government and the people. And the average people I met in China, they loved the idea of Americans and America, and they were incredibly friendly and incredibly generous. I mean, I met a few crackpots who were aggressive about, you know, the differences between the two countries. But in general, it was just a lot of love.
Michael Levy, his book is Kosher Chinese, Living, Teaching, and Eating with China's Other Billion. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks, Jeff. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.